Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
From ABC, this is the 10% Happier podcast. I'm Dan Harris. My guest this time, we're doing a little bit of an experiment. The guests are in Missoula, Montana. This is the first time we're actually doing a interview remotely. These guys are known as the Minimalists. You might have heard of them. They have a very popular podcast. They also have a documentary called Minimalism, a documentary about the important things. Their names are Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus. These guys grew up together. They were living a very sort of typical American life filled with a lot of striving and sort of career ambition, which I can certainly relate to. And I'm sure a lot of you can relate to. And then they made a very radical decision. And part of that, of course, was given that we're having them on this podcast, part of that, of course, involves some meditation. So without further ado, here they are. Gentlemen, thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
So just so the listeners can differentiate between your respective voices, can you introduce yourselves? Josh, you go first. Give me your name and your favorite food.
Hey, I'm Joshua Fields Milburn. And of course, my favorite food is guacamole.
Strong. I agree.
Yeah. My name is Ryan Nicodemus, and my favorite food is Massaman curry, hands down.
Massaman curry.
Yeah, man.
I don't even know if I could pick. Dishes. I don't even know if I could pick that out of a lineup, but I feel like I'm like somewhat culinarily literate. Massaman
curry. It's a Thai dish. Yeah, you should check it out, man. If you're next time you're at a Thai restaurant.
Well, let's get down to the as you guys like to say, important things. There's a lot of, I want to talk about your documentary and minimalism and your lives now, all that stuff. But since this is at least ostensibly a meditation podcast, let's just start there. So how did each of you come to meditation and what does it do for you? So let me start with you. Let's go, Ryan.
Well, you know, for me, we actually wrote about this in our book, Everything That Remains. We talk about this 20 minutes of awesome. So for me, like this was a really good approach to kind of start with meditation where, you know, I literally would just take 20 minutes a day and kind of sit and let my mind wander.
Like,
let
it have all. How did the idea even come to you? Like, well, why did you even start doing 20 minutes of awesome?
It was actually through a friend. His name is Colin Wright. He's got a whole minimalist blog himself called Exile Lifestyle. .com and yeah, he's the one that actually introduced me to it because you know, I was like a lot of people just kind of skeptical with meditation and it being too woo-woo and having to, you know, have some type of spiritual practice related with it, and Colin introduced me to this 20 minutes of awesome and I kind of took to that seemed like a practical approach.
I rudely interrupted you when you were actually describing what the 20 minutes of awesome was. So, A, let me apologize, and B, carry on and tell us what it actually is.
Oh, no worries. So, you know, 20 minutes of awesome is basically just taking 20 minutes to allow your thoughts to just roll and to not judge any thoughts that you have, but to really kind of just sit there and let your brain express itself as much as it wants to. And ultimately, what I found is by kind of letting those thoughts roll, you know, eventually I would feel this calm and I would feel a bit of a quietness after letting it roll for 10 or 15 minutes. And what this does for me, it just kind of helps me reset, especially like if I'm feeling a lot of anxiety, if I'm, you know, stressing out over an interview or a book tour stop or whatever it may be. It was just a way to kind of help me to regain a little bit of control over my thoughts.
So let me press you on this just a little bit, because to my, I'm, this may expose me as some sort of meditation, you know, Stalinist here, but, you know, I just personally, because my mind is so irretrievably disorganized, I needed some structure. So like the structure didn't have to be a lot, but it was at least at the beginning, you know, pay full attention to the feeling of your breath coming in and going out, and then every time you get lost, start again. And when you get lost, you know, when you get distracted, don't judge the thoughts that are coming up. Just make a little note of them and then start again. Do you feel like not having that structure was okay for you? And how do you sit and just watch your thoughts non-judgmentally without getting caught up in them. You know, if like how do you not get caught up in the planning or worrying or whatever else comes up when you sit?
Typically, if I start to get caught in the weeds with a thought, that is when, you know, I would draw my attention back to my breath. There's this, I think it's like a Tai Chi breath where you focus in on bringing in breath to your stomach, then to your chest, and then out through your chest, and then out through your stomach. And it kind of helps me to kind of rein it in a little bit. But what I have found from practicing that 20 minutes of awesome is now I will typically, before I go into the practice, I will think about, okay, what do I want to accomplish today? And because that's usually when I meditate, is in the mornings. And, you know, for example, if I have a mentoring client, or if I got a bunch of mentoring clients that I'm going to talk with, you know, I will sit there and think to myself, okay, I want to be a really good teacher today. Today, I want to be a teacher. So what I've gone from, you know, kind of letting those thoughts wandering and trying not to get, you know, caught too much in the weeds, now I kind of develop this, a little bit of a mantra, I guess, where on my in-breath, I will think to myself, today I will, and then on the exhale, be a teacher. And it's not like I'm actually, you know, saying that loudly in my head. It's more of a, you know, more like a whisper, if anything. But it does help me to focus on what I want to accomplish that day. And it helps me to kind of keep a steady line of consciousness going without it getting too out of hand.
It's funny just listening to you, because I realized that I must be like a rule follower. Because I wanted to know, especially when I began, and to this day, when I started meditating and to this day, I wanted to know, and I still want to know, that I'm doing it right. But you, whatever that means, you know, and that's a whole, that's a whole discussion we can have. But you, sir, you're just like, you came up with a bespoke model for yourself, and you're just going with it. And you sound, at least what's coming through in your voice, is that it sounds like it's working for you, and you're pretty confident about it.
Yeah, I mean, it works really well. I am not a rule follower. Josh will probably be the first to tell you that. But, you know, for me, doing it right means that I'm feeling better, or it's, you know, it's adding value somehow to my daily routine or my daily process or whatever. I am open to, you know, mindful meditation. In fact, you know, I'm kind of going through your week intro right now. I'm on like day two or three.
Oh, on the 10% happier app thing.
Yeah, on the 10% happier app, and it has I can see benefits from it over, you know, just using that the last few days. So that is something that, you know, I am flirting with right now. But you know, I don't claim to be an expert at meditation, and you know, the strategy that I currently use now won't necessarily help every single person listening to this, but I think what it has done for me, going from the 20 minutes of awesome to kind of developing this very simple mantra, it has helped me to get into maybe more a more mindful meditation practice.
All really interesting and cool, and thank you for the plug and trying the thing out. Josh, let me torture you for a second. Do you have a daily practice, and if so, what is it, and how did you start?
I also am a rule follower, although the problem with me is I never know which rules to follow.
Yes, especially in this area, right? Because
Have you tried transcendental meditation at all?
You know, I'm going to get taught how to do transcendental meditation from this guy Bob Roth over at the David Lynch Foundation. So I've done tiny amount of mantra meditation, but and I feel guilty about not being able to talk about it with authority, so I'm going to go learn how to do it so I can say something without being a complete ignoramus.
That's kind of how I feel, although I also feel like I shouldn't have to be taught how to do it as well. And so I'm sort of in a weird
space. You feel that way about, like, you know, operating heavy machinery, you know.
Brain surgery.
Yes. I mean, like, what's wrong with pedagogy?
Yeah, well, I'm somewhat of an autodidact. I don't know if it's just been, like, anti-authoritarian. I never did the whole college thing.
So you're not a rule follower.
Well, I like following my own rules. Establishing really sort of abstruse systems of rules for myself. I like to build walls that I then have to climb over, I suppose. But yes, I do have a daily practice, but I always thought, I kind of hated the idea of meditation. I thought it was just, to be frank, stupid. And then I read this book called 10% Happier. And I know the, that sounds like...
Flattery will get you nowhere. That's not true.
Here's the thing. I had a lot of friends who meditated and expressed the benefits, but it seemed very, it seemed odd to me. And I was very much in the corporate world. You know, Ryan and I, throughout our lotus-eating 20s, we sort of climbed the corporate ladder together. We both grew up really poor and then figured out the key to happiness was, of course, to make more money. And so we spent our 20s working 60, 70, 80 hours a week and stressing ourselves out. By age 27, I was the youngest director in my company's 140-year history. And instead of happiness, I had a lot of anxiety and stress and discontent, and not to mention debt, which then added to the stress, anxiety, and discontent. And it was this vicious cycle that just kept going. And I stumbled across this thing called minimalism and simplified at least the external clutter in my life. But I found that by dealing with that, I was able to start looking inward and dealing with some of the internal clutter. And as I started dealing with the internal clutter, eventually I did stumble across your book, thanks to Sam Harris, I started incorporating just a daily practice into my life with Sam Harris's daily. He sort of had this guided meditation up on his website that made sense to me because it wasn't woo woo. But your story really resonated with me because like me, you were sort of this regular suit and tie guy who didn't want to go live the rest of his life in a cave and be an ascetic and eschew the worldly experiences, but you wanted to have a practice that allowed you to I guess deal with that internal clutter. And so yeah, for me it was just following basic mindfulness meditation in the mornings, and it started out doing it 5 minutes a day, and I used an app called Headspace originally. And that was a great way to sort of have an introduction into that world. And then I just built up to 10, 20 minutes a day. And I'm doing about 25 minutes a day right now. In fact, mine's a little bit different now. I've been doing a daily practice in a dry sauna. So I'm in a dry sauna for 25 minutes a day, and I do meditation while I'm in there.
All right, I want to ask you about that and about what kind of impact it's having on your life. But let me just amplify a few or talk about a few of the things that you mentioned in the foregoing paragraph. Sam Harris, just for the uninitiated, he's a friend of mine. He's also one of the leading atheists in America, made his name railing against organized religion. But very interesting, on the side, he not on the side really, but actually well preceding his becoming a famous atheist, he had a very deep and longstanding meditation practice. And he then wrote a book about that, got into some of that and also some of the brain science. He went off and became a neuroscientist as well. So he writes about it with real authority, both as a meditator and as a scientist, called Waking Up, which is a phenomenal book. I recommend it heartily to everybody. He's also got a podcast called Waking Up that I also recommend to everybody. And he posts guided meditations. In fact, he's going to be coming out with an app to teach people how to do meditation, which I suspect will be amazing, and his guided meditations are amazing. And then you also mentioned Headspace, which is also amazing. I say this even though, I too am in the meditation app game, but Headspace is definitely the industry leader, the first mover, and I know a lot of people who've derived a lot of benefit from it. So anyway, having cleared my throat on all that stuff, tell me about the sauna meditation and what kind of impact has meditation generally had on you? Are you less of a jerk, more of a jerk, neither?
I think you'd have to ask the people around me whether I'm less of a jerk. I can tell you this. People around me, once I started clearing that internal clutter, people at work started saying things like, you know, there were people that work around me started saying things that like, you seem less stressed. You seem so much calmer. You seem nicer. What the hell's going on with you? But I think it was subtle. It wasn't like there was this dramatic 180 degree change. It was pivoting. And so I think if you pivot 5-10 degrees in one direction, it doesn't seem like much at the time, but a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, you're in an utterly different location.
Yeah, I think that's true. So what is the sauna meditation?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. I sit in a sauna for 25 minutes and focus on my breath, and it's just a very basic mindfulness meditation. It started out with Sam Harris's guided meditations, which are free. I'm pretty sure you can find them at his website. And it was just guiding you through that process of focusing on, the sensation in your body and what you're feeling and your breath and letting go, not just of the thoughts, but letting those sensations pass and realizing, it's just occurring to you. And so that's why meditation, I'll tell you that in the sauna, it adds an extra layer because, it's 180 degrees in there, so it gets quite hot. So you're noticing some other sensations in your body as well. And obviously you're sweating, so you have more things to notice. I don't know that I would have started out that way, but there's a bunch of benefits for being in a sauna, having a practice, scientific benefits. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Dr. Rhonda Patrick, but she... Yeah. She's written quite a bit about some of the studies of the benefits of being in a sauna, and so I figured, well, if I'm going to be in there for 25 minutes a day, it's the perfect time for me to do my mindfulness practice as well.
Interesting. So you mentioned Sam Harris's website. It's samharris.org for anybody who's interested in checking it out. So you said something else, Josh, and I want to get both of you guys talking about this, about your personal relationship and the nature of your backgrounds and what brought you to minimalism and what minimalism is. In your documentary, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, but Minimalism, a Documentary About the Important Things. Am I saying that correctly?
That is correct.
Okay. So in your documentary, you talk quite movingly about your childhood, but you had very similar childhoods and were friends since childhood. Can you just tell us a little bit about that, and you guys can hold forth in whatever order you would like.
Sure. Ryan and I are both 35 now, and we've known each other for the better part of 25 years, since we were fat little fifth graders.
And you guys were fat?
Oh, my goodness. we were the two fattest kids in school. It was unbelievable.
Where was this?
This is Dayton, Ohio.
Dayton, Ohio, okay.
Yeah, so we sort of bonded over cheese fries and cheeseburgers and anything with cheese. We both grew up poor on separate sides of town, but there was government assistance and food stamps, and Ryan lived in it was almost cliche, like trailer park. And growing up, we were pretty discontented, and I remember there was this conversation that Ryan and I had in high school. We were sitting at the lunch table, and he figured out that we could be happy if we could just make $50,000 a year. Like, this was the equation, because neither one of our parents had ever made that, and we assumed that the discontent was there because we just weren't making enough money. And while it's true that money can certainly help amplify an experience, I found that by making the same decisions that our parents made, money allowed amplified our experience in a different way throughout our 20s. So instead of going the traditional college route or whatever, I went out and got a sales job when I turned 18, and realized pretty soon I could make $50,000 a year. Except by age 19, I was spending $65,000 a year. So I started experiencing debt for the first time in my life. And I was always spending toward that next paycheck or that next promotion. And by my mid-20s, although I was ostensibly successful, I'd climbed the corporate ladder. I had massive amounts of debt, and I was overweight. I weighed 80 pounds more than I weigh now. And I certainly wasn't happy. I was successful, but only in a very narrow sense, sort of monetarily or status-wise, right? I had an impressive job title, which is problematic because it's one of the first things we do when we meet someone. We ask them, what do you do? And I had an impressive answer to that. You know, I'm the director of operations for 150 retail stores, but I didn't feel a sense of fulfillment or purpose or joy from what I was doing with my life. And instead, I felt all these negative feelings. And then in 2009, my mother died and my marriage ended, both in the same month. And these two events sort of forced me to look around and start to question what had become my life's focus. And what I realized is that I was so focused on so-called success and achievement, and especially on the accumulation of stuff, you know, sort of these trophies of success, these trinkets. And I had lost sight of what was important in my life. I didn't know what was important anymore. And so I stumbled across this thing called minimalism, and found a whole community of people who were sort of jettisoning their material possessions so they could start to focus on what was important. And there were a bunch of different people. It didn't necessarily apply to just a single white guy from a middle-income family who I first stumbled across, a guy named Colin Wright, who's also in the film. But there were minimalist families, a guy named Leo Babalta, and he has six kids and a wife, and they live in San Francisco, and they're this whole minimalist family, and they were minimalist entrepreneurs and minimalist architecture, and how did these things overlap? And so I started sort of letting go of my stuff, and over the course of about eight or nine months, I let go of about 90% of my material possessions, although I think if you visit my home today, you probably don't walk in and say, oh my God, this guy's a minimalist. You just walk in and say, wow, it's really, really freaking tidy in here. And it's because I don't own much, but everything I do own serves a purpose or brings me joy, and everything else is out of the way. And by letting go of that stuff, that external stuff, I was able to start looking inward and say, okay, what's going on inside? Who's the person I want to become? How am I going to define my own success? And why have I been so discontented by this stuff? And what will make me content in the long run?
Oh, I have a million questions, but I want to let Ryan tell his story as well. So, Ryan, you want to take me back to the overweight cheese eating kid who thought 50 grand was going to solve all his problems?
It all started my first day of fifth grade in Dayton, Ohio. Now, I met Josh, like he said, when we were fat little fifth graders, and you know, all I noticed was like there was a kid that was fatter than me. And I was like, sweet, like me and this kid, we're going to get along. And we did. Like we hit it off right away. But yeah, kind of, you know, just to recap what Josh was saying, it was a struggle growing up. And I remember, you know, money always being a source of discontent. And I'm sure a lot of people experience that. So, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do when I got out of high school. All I knew is that I didn't want to experience the same problems. So one summer I was working for my dad. He paints and hangs wallpaper, and we were in this like pretty nice home, and it looked like something that I could afford if I really, you know, put my mind to it, just like a, you know, Midwestern middle class home. And I asked my dad, like, hey dad, how much do I need to make to have a house like this? And he's like, son, if you can make $50,000 a year, you could probably have a house like this. So that is where that equation came from, the $50,000 equaling happiness. Because, you know, I thought having a house like that, it would make me happy. The pictures of the families on the wall, they seemed like they were really, really happy. When I met the homeowners, they seemed really happy. And, you know, I thought it was because they didn't have the same amount of money problems as what, you know, I grew up experiencing. So that's where, you know, I kind of set the bar. And I eventually went to go work with Josh, just in a telecommunications company. And I started climbing the corporate ladder with Josh. I, you know, ostensibly was really, really successful. But like Josh, I was working 60, 70, sometimes 80 hours a week. And I was forsaking some of the most important aspects of my life. I mean, I hardly thought about my health or my relationships, or, you know, God forbid, things that I was passionate about. I mean, work was my passion, you know? And, I did drugs a lot. I drank a lot. I was just using as many pacifiers as I could. And yeah, it got to a point where, I just didn't know what was important anymore. But, you know, as this is kind of going on with me, Josh is dealing with his own stuff with his mother passing away and his marriage ending both in the same month. And I'm watching him go through this. And, you know, as the months go on, I started noticing like small stuff with Josh, right? Like I went to his house and, his apartment, when he first moved out of his home with his wife and moved into his new place. I remember going in there and there was this bracket for a TV on the wall. Like it came with the place. It was like, you know, the perfect spot to put a TV. And I remember looking at that thinking, oh man, like Josh is going to get an awesome TV that goes up there. Cause that was one thing for some reason, him and I always compared each other. Like we always compared ourselves to, it was like, who's got the better TV? Who has the most TVs? So I asked Josh like, hey man, like this is a really nice TV bracket. What kind of TV are you going to get, man? You're going to get one of those like, you know, big HDMI, I think, or HDMI, whatever the latest technology was. That's my fault for using jargon there. I have no idea what I'm talking about when it comes to technology. He was like, you know, I don't know if I'm going to get a TV. Maybe not. And as the months went on, he didn't get a TV. And I was like, oh, that's weird. But, you know, no big deal. He's just, you know, doing his own thing. And then I noticed things like our boss would call him at ridiculous hours, which that's what he did with all his employees. That's how the corporate structure was set up there. We, you know, were answering our phones until midnight and we were waking up at 5 or 6 a.m. getting to emails and returning phone calls. And I got to a point where, you know, I think it was like Christmas Eve and Josh's, our boss like calls Josh and Josh answers his phone and he's like, hello, can I help you? And, our boss is like, yeah, I need a sales update. Like, where are your numbers right now? And Josh was like, I don't know. And he's like, what do you mean you don't know? Where are the numbers? You're supposed to be close to this. You're not close enough to your people. And you just kind of let him go. And then Josh was like, you know, what you're asking right now is unreasonable. It's 6 p.m. on Christmas Eve. I'm out having dinner with friends. And you'll get the report at the end of the day. And that was probably like my first real cue to like, oh my God, like something different is going on with Josh. Like what the heck is going on? So eventually I, after noticing just, you know, these things here and there, I invited him out to a really, really nice restaurant for lunch. We went to Subway. And as we were sitting there like eating our food, I just looked up at him and I'm like, Josh, what is going on with you, man? Like you seem a lot happier. Like, why the hell are you so happy? And that's when he introduced me to this thing called minimalism. I thought he was going to tell me that they had put him on Prozac or something. Like, that's really what I wanted to know. Like, what drugs are you on, man? But no, it wasn't anything like that. It was this practice called minimalism that he started introducing into his life. And he, you know, went from talking about his, you know, experience of kind of jettisoning things over the last several months to make room for life's most important things. He then showed me an entire community of people who called themselves minimalists. Josh was describing that community earlier. And I just kind of went down that rabbit hole as you do on Google and YouTube. You search one topic and then you're like, you know, stuck on it for hours and hours. And I didn't see any one person whose life I wanted to emulate. But what I saw was just a lot of people who were very passionate people and they were living meaningful lives and they all attribute it to this thing called minimalism. So I got really excited and I went to Josh. I'm like, all right, man, I'm in. I want to do it. I want to be a minimalist. Now what do I do? Cause I didn't really know where to start. All I knew was like, I didn't want to spend 8 or 9 months paring down my items, you know, typical like American got to have it now attitude. I wanted fast results. So that's where Josh and I, we came up with this crazy idea called a packing party where we decided to pack all my belongings. I had like it was a 2000 square foot condo, 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, 2 living rooms. I have no idea why I ever.
This
is in Dayton. I have no idea why I ever thought I would need 2 living rooms.
That would be millions and millions of dollars if it was in New York City. I don't know how the Dayton real estate.
Right. It's about a tenth of that cost in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
But yeah.
Two living rooms.
two living rooms, man. And I had like, and I had it all like furnished and yeah, just like packed to the gourd with stuff. So I literally packed up everything as if I were moving. So Josh came over, helped me pack up my clothes, my kitchenware, my towels, my TVs, my electronics, framed photographs and paintings, my toiletries. I mean, even my furniture. We literally packed up everything and pretended like I was moving. So what I did is over the next 3 weeks, I unpacked things as I needed it, just day by day. Like I really wanted to get a sense of what was bringing value to my life. And so you can imagine, like, I unpacked my toothbrush, some clothes for work. You know, I unpacked a six pack from the fridge, whatever. Like I went day by day, just kind of doing this practice and taking notes and writing. And by the end of the 3 weeks, I had 80% of my stuff still packed up. Hmm. And I just remember like looking at it all and just thinking, my God, like here is tens of thousands of dollars worth of stuff that I've brought into my life to make me happy. And it's not doing its job. So, you know, that's where I decided to kind of make this change. And I donated and I sold all of it. And that's, you know, when I went to Josh and I'm like, dude, this is a really interesting lifestyle. This packing party is a really interesting experiment. I think we could totally start up a website like these other guys and share our perspective with our journey into this. And it was kind of like an outlet at first, you know, just something to kind of jot stuff down and just to put it out there, I guess. I know too, like when I put stuff out there, it makes me way more accountable. So that was a piece of it too. But yeah, that's really where the minimalists.com started. It was with that packing party story.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
So did you move to an apartment that had only one living room?
I did.
And
yeah,
did you guys
rent...
quit the job right away, or were you you were still at the telecom retail company and just doing the website, or what happened?
Yeah, we were both still in the corporate world for a while. I think it took a while to realize, like, once you clear that excess, it wasn't getting rid of the stuff. That wasn't the end result. I really think that's the first step that changes everything, right? And so letting go led me to asking some deeper questions about my values and what do I actually value in my life. And eventually I learned that there's nothing wrong with having 9 to 5. I think we all have to pay the bills. But what I was doing in that corporate setting where I was, it didn't align with the person I wanted to be. It wasn't a person who I aspired to be. In fact, the guys who I had aspired to be like as I climbed that corporate ladder, I discovered as I got closer to them that they were kind of miserable. Mm. Like the guys I wanted to be were miserable. Mm. And of course, we all always tell ourselves like, oh, this, I'll be different, right? But if I follow the same recipe, I'm going to get the same result. And so by, I guess, focusing on letting go of my stuff, I started to figure out these things that I thought were important, that I dedicated my life to, they aren't important at all. And so why am I pursuing the same path? And so, yeah, I while I downsized my life, I started letting go of those things, but also started letting go of what was most difficult, which was my identity. I was so tied up into what I did to earn a paycheck, as opposed to the person I wanted to be, as opposed to my relationships that were important to me and my health and contributing beyond myself in a meaningful way, I realized that I needed to focus on what my values were, not on this meme that we've been sold of the American dream.
Yeah, so ultimately, Josh laid himself off. his boss went to him and said, "Hey, we need to save, $1.5 million, and we need you to come up with a plan to do that." So, he did that, and he had to write people's names down and had to lay people off to do this. And when he handed in that list, he put his name at the top of the list, and it was about 8 months before I left, but it was really inspiring to watch him do this. So what I did, my boss, he knew about the website. Josh had left, and he knew we were friends. So I kind of thought he had an inkling that maybe I would probably take off eventually. And I sat him down at one point and, I'm like, "Hey man, I'm just curious. Like, if I ever decided to leave here, who do you think we would replace my job with? Who do you think we would use to fill this spot?" And, at that point, so my job at the time was selling small and medium business sales for 150 retail stores. And I had implemented this program into these stores that was working really efficiently. And we were talking about it, and he's like, "I don't know if you left, if I would fill your spot. Things are going so well." And I'm like, "Huh, it's a really interesting thought, isn't it?" And then a month later, I got sat down. I got a text that said, "Hey Ryan, we need you to meet me in room, 812, the room that I have been to several times across from HR and laid off people in." So I knew it was coming, and I got laid off, and it was about a year and a half after kind of starting that journey where I left my job.
So, Josh, when you left, how did you feed yourself?
Well, I think the bad advice...
Because there's only so far you can take minimalism.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Unless you're like harvesting acorns in the park or something like that.
Now that's minimalist.
Yeah, I guess there's a fine line there between insanity and minimalism. When I walked away from the corporate world, I didn't have a need anymore to make the same. I wasn't tied to the same lifestyle I had previously, because even though I made really good money in the corporate world, I made a few a few hundred thousand dollars a year, which in Dayton, Ohio is a lot of money, and I spent even better money though, and so that equation just didn't work. And so before I left the corporate world, I focused very hard on paying down massive amounts of debt, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, and I also focused on untethering myself from expenses. Now, I had to pay the bills. I still had to have a roof over my head. My initial plan when I walked away from the corporate world, people were asking me, where are you going? Who's the competitor you're going to? Can you take me with you? And the answer was there wasn't anywhere I was going. My initial plan was just to be a barista at a local coffee shop and to write fiction full time. That's what I wanted to do. I always had a passion for writing fiction, and literature was just this thing I wanted to do. And a few months after that, this thing called the Minimalists sort of took off, and I realized that I could still apply that passion, but in this sort of nonfiction capacity. And so, Ryan and I wrote a few books together. I started teaching a writing class online, and doing things that aligned with my values to help pay the bills, as opposed to doing something just to earn a paycheck. And now everything that I do, it's not like I'm allergic to money. I think we all want to make an income, but it's no longer the primary driver for doing what I do. And the best way to be able to say that is to untether myself from this old lifestyle of having a car payment and having debt and having these things that added these sort of creature comforts to my life, but also added a constant low level, or honestly a medium level, anxiety to my life. And And those things are gone now.
What little luxury, what or big luxury, what did you have to let go of that sucked the most?
Man, for me, it was my like really nice Toyota Avalon I had. It was like brand new with, you know, Bluetooth and sunroof, and it was awesome. Well, you know, that was, I think, so brand new then would have been like a 2010 maybe or 2011. But, you know, now I drive a 2004 Toyota Corolla. So it's got, you know, about 230,000 miles on it. It leaks when it rains from the sunroof. So sometimes I look at that, I'm like, man, you know, I really would love to like get a new car, one that doesn't leak when it rains. But at the end of the day, the cost of that new car, it's not going to bring me an exponential amount of happiness. It's not going to add an exponential amount of value to my life. Because when it leaks, it's not a big deal. Like, it's a couple drops. It's not like it's pouring in. The car is, it runs really, really well. But yeah, I mean, I do look back and think, man, like having that brand new Avalon was really, really awesome. But, you know, for me, I just look at it and think, at what cost?
Yeah, I don't really miss those things though, Dan. I mean, I had two Lexuses.
Two? One for you and one for your wife, or you just took one?
One for me and one for my wife. Okay. Also had a Land Rover, you know, just because. And
you just like switch, take different cars on different days?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you have a three-car garage, you have to fill it with something.
You took this pretty far. I mean, commercialism, materialism, like you were...
Yeah, I mean, consumerism. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think consumption is the problem. I think compulsory consumption is the problem.
Or compulsive consumption.
Yeah, absolutely. But also compulsory in the sense that we feel like it's what we're supposed to do, or it's what we must do in order to achieve some sort of status or enlightenment. And man, advertisements are really good at making us believe how inadequate we are, right? And I will be adequate as soon as I have that car. But once I get the car, then well, I need something different, or I need something better, or I need to focus on some other area of my life. And so the void continues to widen, and we try to fill it with more stuff. But of course, that just that widens the void even farther. So yeah, I mean, I had a lot of stuff. I'll tell you that I don't necessarily miss anything that I've gotten rid of, though. It wasn't like there was anything that truly sucked letting go of. In fact, on our podcast, someone called. We have people call in and ask questions, and someone said, you know, it seems like you guys didn't really get rid of anything important. And my answer was, well, yeah, we didn't get rid of anything important, and that's really, really the point, is the things that we thought were important weren't actually important. They weren't adding value to our lives. They weren't serving a purpose or bringing us joy, and so. So the thing is, like, if I get rid of something and I'm depriving myself of it, then I can bring it back into my life. Minimalism isn't about deprivation. It's about living a more meaningful life with less stuff, but a lot more in a broader sense, relationships and people and creativity and passion.
So just to pick up the narrative thread here, you said before that not long after you – laid yourself off and with dreams of being the next F. Scott Fitzgerald or whatever, this website, The Minimalists, started to take off. What is The Minimalist? What do you do?
Well, first I'll tell you, I think what do you do is life's most dangerous question, because like I said, we ask it all the time, and broadly it could mean anything. Well, I drink water, I write on little yellow notepads, I go to concerts. But really what we're asking is generally, when we ask that question, I'm not saying you're asking this, but as a society, when we ask that question, what we're saying is, where do you work? What's your title? How much money do you earn so I can compare you to me on the socioeconomic ladder? And the reason we don't posit the question that way is because we kind of sound like jerks if we say it like that. So instead we say, what do you do? And then we spend the next 15, 20 minutes talking about something that we do to earn a paycheck, but doesn't necessarily mean that we're passionate about or even that interested in. And so what do I do? I do a lot of things. If you're asking, what do we do to earn a living? I mean, we do a bunch of stuff now. Ryan and I are partners in a business. We own a coffee shop in St. Petersburg, Florida. I teach a writing class online. We've written 3 books that thankfully have done fairly well. And hopefully this documentary will do well enough that it'll actually make its money back from all the production and promotional costs that we put out there. And so we do a lot of things, but everything I do now aligns with the person who I aspire to be. You know, I'm 35 years old now. I'm constantly aspiring to be my 40-year-old self, you know, looking at that horizon and realizing once I get to the horizon, I don't get there. Like, there's always a new horizon. So once I get to 40, I'll be aspiring to be my 41, 45-year-old self or whatever it may be.
So wait, let me just, you own a coffee shop? How mm-hmm. how did that start? And I guess you did work as a barista for a minute, but why there? But you live in Montana, so...
We do.
Talk to me about that.
Sure. Well, we focus on one project a year, typically, and so I'll just kind of go back a little bit. In 2012, Ryan and I moved from Dayton, Ohio, out to Montana. We started a publishing company, so we could publish our own books and also some other creative folks' books that we, we look at other people's work and say, I really wish I would have done that. Let me help you along your journey. And so we moved out to Montana just because it was really beautiful and it allowed us to focus on some creative endeavors, write a book called Everything That Remains. And which was sort of a memoir of the last 5 years of our lives. And in doing so, we didn't want to follow a traditional model and wait for a publisher and all that stuff. So we started our own publishing company and we moved out here to do that. And in 2013, actually that was in 2013. In 2014, we went on the road. We basically donated a year of our lives. We went out to 100 different cities in 8 different countries. Spreading this message of minimalism and really focused on...
And this is what you see in the documentary, just so people know.
Yeah, absolutely. So what you see in the documentary is that 2014 tour. And we went all over the place and had a bunch of events and just kind of started out with 2 to 6 people showing up. And then eventually, as the message spread, hundreds of people started showing up. And it resonated with all different types of people, no matter where they were on the socioeconomic ladder. We had a former homeless person show up in Adelaide, Australia. We had a factory worker and a CEO show up at the same event in Atlanta. And what I realized is that while all these people lead considerably different lives, they're all striving to still live a more meaningful life. And that they're asking the same question, how do I live more deliberately? And it manifests differently. You know, for that CEO, he was trying to figure out why he gets so angry when the smallest things happen, like his 4th TV goes out in his 2nd home. Whereas the factory worker is trying to figure out, should I buy a new pair of blue jeans or pay my rent? And so these questions, they lead to the same place. And so, but we basically donated a year of our lives to get out there and spread this message at a whole bunch of free events. And in 2015, last year, it was we wanted to focus on a year of contribution. So we, along with our audience at our website, we found different ways to contribute to different communities. And we built some wells in Malawi. We funded a high school for a year in Kenya. We built an elementary school in Laos for 66 kids there. And we also met some amazing people in St. Petersburg, Florida, who had this awesome idea to make this community hub that was also a really great coffee shop. And so we had an opportunity to contribute to that in a different way by becoming business partners in that. And so it was serendipity that led us there, but it aligned with what we wanted to do and really set up this community hub. And I was really familiar with St. Petersburg because that's where my mother was when she passed away. So yeah. I had ties in that community already. And then this year, our focus has been getting this documentary out into the world.
I watched your documentary, and the first voice that comes up is my voice. And I think, I don't know if I'm a minimalist, like, or maybe I'm just a huge hypocrite, because, if I look at my desk at home, there's a little glass Buddha that my wife bought me at Barney's. So, and we have a kid. And there's just a boatload of – he is a maximalist. I mean, he's got every crayon and every color and every toy and every color and just everything. Just the apartment is filled with stuff. I defy you to be a minimalist with a 1.5-year-old. But
sure.
And yet I get that letting go, this term you use – with reference to physical things, letting go in a much larger sense is – the sine qua non of the Buddhist path of toward enlightenment, whatever, however you want to define that. And obviously, when you die, you're going to be letting go of everything. So I'm trying to figure out, I don't know if I'm doing a good job of this. Like, am I missing something here? Should I be going minimalist? What would that even mean? So save me.
You want rules, right? I wish there was a minimalist rule book, because I'm sure if we could put out, here's 100 things you should own and you'll be happy, because that'd be easy and you could follow it. But of course, the things that add value to my life are going to be different for you.
I don't think the I like that little glass Buddha that my wife bought me. Like, I like kids' toys.
But who says you can't be a minimalist and have that? So we're not ascetics, right?
No, I get it. I don't misunderstand what you're saying, but I guess, yeah, I bet I have a lot more stuff than you. And I suspect if I went through it and with my wife and we only kept the things that gave us joy, I'm sure we would lose a lot of stuff. But still, I feel like I'm not overly oppressed by my stuff, and yet I have a lot of stuff, I think.
Right. Well, the soundbite answer is that minimalism is the thing that gets us past the things so we can focus on life's most important things, which actually aren't things at all. But that doesn't mean that there are. There's anything inherently wrong with stuff. The problem is the attachment and the meaning that we give to those things. And we get so caught up in what these things mean to us that I think we lose focus on other stuff. And the question I would have for you is do these things actually get in the way, or do they augment your experience of life? And for me, the things that I own now, they augment my experience of life. They improve it. And I'll do little stoical experiments from time to time. I'm definitely not a stoic, but I'll occasionally temporarily deprive myself of something just to figure out whether or not it's truly adding value to my life. And I think you don't ever get there, though. You don't get to the 1,000 things you own and then you're happy. I mean, Dan, did you know that the average American household has 300,000 items in it? And I probably had more than that. Now I was a well-organized hoarder, but all that you know. So we see this sort of continuum or the spectrum where we think the organized people are on one side, and the hoarders are on the other side. But it's all still one continuum. I was a well-organized hoarder, which means instead of being a contestant on the show Hoarders or a candidate for that show, I had all of my stuff in an ordinal system of boxes and bins stored in my basement, but it still looked like a maze of unused stuff that was actually getting in the way and preventing me from pursuing a life of meaning or a life that I wanted to pursue. And so, yeah, I got rid of 90% of my stuff, but let's do the math there. I mean, I probably still have 20 or 30,000 items, whatever that means. I haven't counted my stuff, although I did once as a parody, and people took it very seriously. I wrote an essay about having 288 items because I was sort of making fun of the people who do count their stuff, but in a ribbing, very nice, friendly way. Because we have friends who, like Colin, who's in the documentary, who has 52 things. Everything he owns fits in his backpack. That's great for him because it allows him to do what he's passionate about, which is travel around the world. He moves to a new country every 4 months, and everything he owns fits in his backpack because he doesn't own a kitchen table because it would be hard for him to carry that onto a plane.
I'm sure he also doesn't have a 1.5-year-old.
Right. No, same here. And I have a 3-year-old now, and my life now at 35 looks different from what it did at 32 or at 28. And so that ideal self is constantly changing as well. And so as my life changes, I'll bring new things into my life that add value. I also have to question the things I hold on to, because just because something's adding value to my life today, it doesn't mean it will 5 years from now. And so I have to keep being cognizant of that.
Yeah, I didn't mean to sound... Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. I don't know. But I definitely didn't mean to sound defensive about me and my stuff. Maybe I'm just naturally kind of minimalist in my tendencies anyway, because I don't. If I were to just sort of mentally do an inventory of all of my stuff, I don't have like lots of extra stuff in boxes packed away. Like I only have the stuff I want to have.
But you're a Buddhist.
And I guess that's probably true. I mean, definitely it's true that I'm a Buddhist. I don't know that I'm a good Buddhist.
but we get people come to us, and we were on tour in Mississippi. We had, you know, this young Christian couple come to us. It's so great to see two guys out here spreading Jesus's message. And then we were up in Seattle, you know, a few months later, and someone said, it's so great to see these guys out here spreading these Buddhist maxims. And we got an email that said, you know, Muhammad was the original minimalist. And so what I find is that while this isn't a new idea, it is a new reaction to, or it's an old idea that's a reaction to a new problem. This problem of post-industrial consumerism, which really skyrocketed, you know, starting in the 90s. We had Juliet Shore, the economist from Boston, who's in the documentary, and she talks about how, you know, this consumerism, this unchecked consumerism, really started in the 1990s, and we now as a country, just as America, we have $12 trillion worth of debt. I mean, it's impossible for us to even understand what $12 trillion means, right? I mean, if you were to spend $1 million every single day since the birth of the Buddha, you still wouldn't have spent $1 trillion by now. Mm. And we have $12 trillion in consumer debt.
Look, there's no question. I mean, in my mind, I mean, I agree, and I think I probably said this in your movie, that we're constantly on the hunt. We're constantly chasing the next thing that we think is going to do it for us. And obviously that shows up in lots of areas of our life, not just in our buying habits, but in our eating habits, in our relationships, and in our professional ambitions. And this is the sort of human sickness, right? This is what the Buddha would call suffering, that we are always think we're always looking for the thing that's just going to do it for us, and there isn't such a thing unless you believe in nirvana. That being said, I wonder sometimes as I watch the movie, like, is there a kind of an anti-capitalist vibe to it? And do you think there is?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's still the best system that there is. You know,
a bad system, but the best there is, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
isn't
that what? Or democracy has been described that way, I think.
Yeah, and I think capitalism is similar to that. I mean, the problems with our society is not capitalism. The problem is us and the unchecked desires. And I think marketers do a really good job. There isn't anything inherently wrong with advertising, but there is something sort of inherently wrong with us, because we are constantly searching and searching and searching. And so, no, I don't think it's anti-capitalist at all. And in fact, it's pro intentionality and being intentional with the decisions that we make each day. We all have resources, and money is just one of them, but we have time and attention and the people around us, our relationships, our health is a resource, and we have to figure out how we're spending these on a daily basis.
So if there are people listening who have two living rooms or an extra car just because they needed to fill a three-car garage or whatever, if there are people listening who feel like that they are in fact burdened by their stuff and they're interested in exploring how they could dip their toe in the minimalist water, what would you recommend? I mean, obviously your website, but what are the things one could do?
Well, if they read all three of our books, they'll be cured, Dan. No, I'm kidding.
You sound like a few of the self-help gurus I know.
Man, I really wish that was the case. You know, for anyone out there who wants to dip their toe into minimalism water, I'll suggest something that has worked for tens of thousands of our readers. Josh and I came up with this thing called the 30-day minimalism game. And it works like this. Essentially, you find someone who, you know, wants to declutter as well, whether it's a family member, coworker, friend, whatever. You find someone who wants to do this with you, because it's always better when you have support. And plus, like, you know, we all know that decluttering is boring. So when you're in it with someone else, it makes it a little less boring.
Actually, decluttering isn't that boring. Just, I mean, I'm not super into organizing the house. I mean, my wife is, but well, like once in a while, and maybe this is why I don't feel burdened by my stuff, because once in a while she will help me like prune, and I actually find it kind of invigorating, getting rid of stuff that I don't need anymore.
Yeah, I certainly think that can be the case, especially when you get into it and you start to realize all the benefits of like, wow, I can see my floor now, or wow,
yes,
like I have room. Yeah, I have more room in my house now.
Oh wow, we had a fourth cat. I didn't even know that.
Right, man, it had kittens. Right, exactly. So the 30-day minimalism game, like basically, you just find someone who wants to get rid of some stuff, and you both agree to get rid of one thing at the beginning of the month, on the first of the month. On the second day, you each get rid of two things. And then on the third day, each person gets rid of three things. And it starts out really, really easy, right? Up until you get to like day 19, you got to get rid of 19 things. And then day 20, you got to get rid of 20 things. It gets a little bit more difficult. So the game works like this. Like, you know, whoever goes the longest wins. If both people make it to the end of the month, they both kind of win because they have gotten rid of almost 500 items. But that has worked for so many people to kind of dip their toe into it.
I think get you that momentum that you need too, right? Because we get overwhelmed and we try to start with the difficult stuff. You know, for me, I actually started with the difficult stuff, and it made other things easier in time. But it was the hardest thing to do. It was when my mom died. I was trying to get rid of a bunch of these sentimental items, right? And that's the worst place to start because you have this attachment to so many things. Over time, I realized that the memories aren't in our things. Our memories are inside us. But we attach all these memories to these things, and it's true those things can be triggers for memories, but by getting rid of the stuff, I'm not actually getting rid of the memory. So start with something easy, and I think the minimalism game allows you to do that.
Fair enough. Well, you've provoked a lot of thinking on my end. I'm keeping that expensive Buddha my wife bought for me. But
sounds like you really love it, man. I would encourage you to keep it.
Yes, yeah. Before we go here, let's do a completely unrestrained bout of pimping whatever you want to pimp. Like what are you interested in us doing, buying, seeing, reading of yours?
We don't have anything to sell to you, really. If you want to check out the film, you're welcome to do that. It's just called Minimalism. But if the listeners leave here with one message, I hope it's this. Love people and use things, because the opposite never works.
Okay, there's another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please make sure to subscribe, rate us. And if you want to suggest topics we should cover or guests we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. I also want to thank heartily the people who produce this podcast and really do pretty much all the work. Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, Sarah Amos, Andrew Kalb, Steve Jones, and the head of ABC News Digital, Dan Silver. I'll talk to you next Wednesday. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now, I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, The Competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think, some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.